Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Bob Doty reporting. The head of the UN's nuclear watchdog met with Iranian officials Thursday in Tehran in the latest effort to resolve long-standing questions about the country's nuclear program. The International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA chief Yukiya Amano, held talks with the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani. The meeting in Tehran comes as negotiators from Iran and a group that includes the United States, Britain, China, France, Russia, and Germany work in Vienna toward a comprehensive agreement that would limit Iran's nuclear activity in exchange for sanctions relief. Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis says he will resign his post if Greek voters approve Sunday's referendum on bailout terms demanded by the country's European creditors. Varoufakis said in a televised interview Thursday that if Greece accepts the EU creditors' bailout proposal on Sunday, he will not be finance minister the following day. Varoufakis says he expects Greeks to reject the bailout proposal, which would require tax increases and spending cuts in exchange for further aid. On Wednesday, Greek Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras said he is sticking with plans for Sunday's referendum, but expressed willingness to accept terms much like those his government has previously rejected. In response, German Chancellor Angela Merkel again said there will be no more negotiations until the outcome of Sunday's referendum is clear. Greece is cut off from further European aid after failing on Tuesday to meet a midnight deadline for repaying $1.8 billion to the International Monetary Fund. This is VOA News. Authorities in Tunisia have detained 12 people in connection with last week's attack at a beach resort that killed 38 people, an official said Thursday. The gunman was killed by security forces following the mass shooting Friday in the city of Sousse. Officials have said he was the only shooter, but that they were searching for people who may have provided help before the attack. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility, just as it did when two gunmen killed 21 people at the Bardo Museum in Tunis in March. The U.S. economy had a net gain of 223,000 jobs in June, and the unemployment rate was down 0.2 percentage point to 5.3%. That is the lowest jobless rate since 2008. However, officials say the rate fell partly because more than 400,000 people gave up their job search and are therefore no longer counted as unemployed. Thursday's report from the Labor Department says job gains were seen in business services, healthcare, and the retail trade. Job losses continued in the mining sector, including the petroleum industry, which has been hard hit by falling oil prices. White House officials say the U.S. economy has had a net gain of 2.9 million jobs over the past year and 12.8 million over the past 5 years. The Obama administration's efforts to reestablish diplomatic relations with Cuba is expected to be harshly challenged by the Republican-controlled Congress, particularly with regards to the Cuban military. Just last week, Representative Devin Nunes, chairman of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, introduced a bill in the House of Representatives that would ban Americans from engaging in any financial transactions with the Cuban military or the Cuban Ministry of the Interior, or with any entity controlled by the military or the ministry. The legislation was intended to ensure that Cuban people, and not Castro's regime's repressive security apparatus, benefit from any increased trade resulting from the Obama administration's policy to normalize U.S.-Cuban relations. Philippine officials say at least 36 people are dead and dozens more are missing after a ferry capsized in the central part of the country. The Kim Nirvana was carrying 189 people Thursday when officials say it went down only a kilometer from shore. Coast Guard says at least 127 people have been rescued. The United States has asked Switzerland to extradite seven officials with the World Football Organization FIFA in an ongoing corruption probe. Swiss justice officials said Thursday they have received the request of the seven FIFA officials who were arrested in Zurich in May on suspicion of bribery. I'm Bob Doty in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
A new UN report gives a bleak forecast through October for the Horn of Africa and the Great Lakes region. It warns of more intense and widespread violence, greater population displacement, and economic shocks.
That's VOA's Joe DiCapua reporting. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, gunmen shot and killed a security guard at a Cairo bank this morning. The streets of Burundi's capital appear calm today as the nation waits for results of last Monday's vote for members of parliament. And Reuters news agency reports the Liberian Ministry of Health today confirms a third case of the Ebola virus disease in Liberia. We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Nigeria, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, gunmen shot and killed a security guard at a Cairo bank this morning. The shooting followed a series of extremist attacks yesterday on Egyptian military checkpoints in northern Sinai and a police raid on a Cairo home in which nine members of the Muslim Brotherhood were killed. Yesterday's coordinated assaults by a militant group linked to Islamic State forces were the largest in decades of Sinai fighting. Reports that as many as 100 Islamists and dozens of military died are unconfirmed. Among those killed in the October 6th apartment raid in a Cairo suburb were ex-lawmaker Nasser al-Hafi, prominent Muslim Brotherhood leader Abdel Fattah Atiyah, and two men sentenced to death in absentia by a Cairo judge. The Interior Ministry said the nine were planning terrorist attacks. Police said they found three rifles and ammunition in the apartment and that three officers were injured in the raid. Muslim Brotherhood spokesperson Mohammed Montasser tweeted a claim that the men were unarmed and were shot by police after their arrest. Since the government ousted President Mohamed Morsi 2 years ago and banned the Muslim Brotherhood, violence has escalated in the Sinai. Authorities in Tunisia have detained 12 people in connection with last week's attack at a beach resort that killed 38 people, an official said today. The gunman, Saif Rezgi, was killed by security forces following the mass shooting last Friday in the city of Sousse. Officials have said he was the only shooter, but that they were searching for people who may have provided help before the attack. The Islamic State group claimed responsibility, just as it did when two gunmen killed 21 people at the Bardo Museum in Tunis in March. Officials said Rezgi and the Bardo gunmen trained in Libya at the same time. Most of the dead in both attacks were foreign tourists. Many of those killed last Friday were British nationals, while others were citizens of Germany, Ireland, Belgium, and Portugal. Well, a new UN report gives a bleak forecast through October for the Horn of Africa and the Great Lakes region. It warns of more intense and widespread violence, greater population displacement, and economic shocks. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
OCHA, the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, says the Horn of Africa and the Great Lakes region are home to some of the world's most vulnerable people. That's despite economic growth and progress in achieving the Millennium Development Goals. The report states that there has been a step change in the region's threat level in 2015. Pete Manfield is head of OCHA's regional office for Eastern Africa.
If we look at what the dominating humanitarian characteristics were for Eastern Africa 9 months ago, you could summarize it as a persistent, high chronic food and nutrition crises or emergency in pockets across the region, with a slow burn refugee crisis mostly dominated from South Sudan.
Things have worsened since then.
We've seen Burundi, the political crisis in Burundi, which is increasingly having regional impacts, not just in terms of refugee outflows, but actually starting to threaten stability in the wider region. We've seen the economy in South Sudan reached crisis point, both in terms of oil revenues and its ability to pay civil servants. And of course, we've seen Yemen get substantially worse, and we're on the verge of that becoming a new global crisis.
The humanitarian scenario says the situation in Burundi will most likely remain restive for the foreseeable future. Well over 140,000 people have fled the country since early April, after President Pierre Nkurunziza declared he would seek a third term. Yemen is included with the African hotspots because thousands are fleeing fighting there and going to Djibouti and Somalia. Those countries have their own migrant, refugee, and food security problems. Those fleeing Yemen are not only citizens, but African migrants and refugees now forced to return to the continent.
Now, these three crises, coupled with the protracted situation in food and nutrition, are presenting a new threat. And we think the line has basically been passed in the sand in terms of threat level. This is having compounding impacts on states, not just those in conflict, but those that are neighboring to conflict centers.
Manfield says these crises coincide with a record level of global humanitarian needs.
Our concern is that the region will be overlooked, both politically and financially. We need, obviously, adequate finance to respond, and we need the right level of political engagement to solve crises at their source. And that's never been more needed now in Burundi and South Sudan and Yemen in order to stop this deteriorating further.
Crises in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East have a common byproduct: thousands of migrants and refugees fleeing to Europe. Unresolved conflict and violence in Somalia and the eastern DRC are having detrimental effects on neighboring countries. These include attacks by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab in Kenya and the flood of refugees from Congo. Meeting all the humanitarian needs takes money, and there's stiff competition for it.
Overall, aggregate humanitarian funding levels globally has never been higher. The problem is that the humanitarian requirements are also at a historic high. So the requirements globally for humanitarian assistance, if you add up all of the UN appeals, is just over $20 billion. That is an unprecedented level of requirements. And what we found is that the overall level of contributions as they stand at the end of last year was about $8.5, $9 billion. What we don't see is donors finding more resources to fund commensurate at the same level.
Manfield says, as a result, when funding decisions are made, Syria, Nepal, and South Sudan may get the bulk of the money. Less funding would be available for new crises, like Burundi.
Burundi's having a very, very difficult time attracting funding because it's having to compete with other crises globally in the region, which are sucking vast amounts of money.
He says Syria accounts for about 30% of the entire global aid requirement for 2015. The OCHA official says that humanitarian responses alone cannot solve these crises, adding political solutions can. He warns there will be massive humanitarian consequences if that does not happen. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up on 14 minutes past the hour, this is Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. The streets of Burundi's capital, Bujumbura, appear calm today as the nation waits for results of last Monday's vote for members of parliament. The ruling party is expected to win most of the seats in a prelude to controversial presidential election scheduled for July 15th. Political protest continues as five demonstrators and a policeman died Wednesday in clashes in Bujumbura's Tiboke district. Police say they confiscated two machine guns and ammunition after they dispersed protesters. Burundi has experienced street violence and public protest since President Pierre Nkurunziza decided in April to run for a third term in office. Regional leaders and international donors have echoed Burundi's local political opposition in calling for election delays. At least 77 people have died in street clashes, and more than 140,000 have fled the country. Reuters news agency reports the Liberian Ministry of Health has today confirmed a third case of the Ebola virus disease in Liberia, a country that was declared Ebola-free in early May. Two added cases have been confirmed after the discovery that a 17-year-old boy in rural Margibi County died of the virus last Sunday. The youth was thought to have died of malaria until tests confirmed the virus after his burial. More than 175 people are being monitored who may have had contact with any of the three men. The two new cases are 24 and 27 years old. Deputy Health Minister Tolbert Nyanswa reports the two are in stable condition. No other information about the infected men has been made available. More than 4,800 Liberians have died of the disease that swept through three West African countries for more than a year. Two suicide bombers blew themselves up near a hospital in Maiduguri, Nigeria today as the nation's new vice president visited refugee camps near the city. Yemi Osinbajo was meeting with refugees who had fled Boko Haram attacks when twin blasts were heard across the city. More than 1.5 million Nigerians have been displaced by violence. Maiduguri has been the scene of several suicide bomb attacks. It is the state capital of Borno and the birthplace of the Boko Haram sect before it took up arms 6 years ago against the Nigerian government. In other news, the Associated Press reports the government of Chad has arrested Bana Fanane, a Boko Haram leader who engineered arms transfers. A Chadian prosecutor says they arrested Fanane on Sunday. Well, 1 month after his inauguration, Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has tweaked military strategy and shaken up the state oil company, but has yet to appoint a cabinet. Chris Stein reports on what this says about Mr. Buhari's leadership style.
In his campaign, Mr. Buhari vowed to bring change to Nigeria, but did not give a timetable for when that would happen. Just over a month after his inauguration, Mr. Buhari's tenure has been marked as much by what he has not done as by what he has. The country still does not have a cabinet. Mr. Buhari has not appointed any ministers, nor even circulated a list of names. His biggest moves thus far have been to fire the board of the Nigerian National Petroleum Corporation, the state-owned oil company that has been dogged for years by allegations of corruption. He also ordered the military command to relocate to the northeastern city of Maiduguri, a frequent target of the violent Islamist Boko Haram insurgency that he has pledged to crush. But much remains to be done. Nigeria's treasury has been ravaged by a global drop in the price of crude oil, the country's top commodity. Mr. Buhari himself says the treasury is virtually empty. And Boko Haram is as deadly as ever. It has carried out numerous suicide bombings and gun attacks in Maiduguri and elsewhere in the northeast since the president's May 29th swearing-in. The spokesman for Mr. Buhari's All Progressives Congress Party says the president is dealing with an unprecedented situation. His victory over former President Goodluck Jonathan in March was the first time an opposition candidate succeeded in defeating an incumbent Nigerian president through an election, and it marked the end of the 16-year grip on the presidency by the People's Democratic Party. Lai Mohammed says Mr. Buhari is assessing the state of Nigeria's vast federal government before he appoints ministers.
The president is taking his time. I can assure you that definitely not too much damage has been done to governance.
Political commentator Chris Ngwodo says Mr. Buhari may have had to curtail any grand plans he might have once had, now that he is in office.
While the initial intention and certainly everybody's hope was that the new administration would hit the ground running, when they got there, they realized that the true state of things was worse than they had previously anticipated.
And all the rhetoric about the economy may be one way for Mr. Buhari to mitigate the public's high hopes for his administration.
During the course of the campaign, they raised expectations. Now they have to manage those expectations. And one of the ways of managing them is to stress that the federal treasury is in very bad shape.
Sadiq Abba, a lecturer of political economy at the University of Abuja, says President Buhari's past experience as petroleum minister and then as a military ruler speaks to his history of slow, methodical governance.
He is unpredictable. He is highly unassuming. He plays by the rule, and he takes his time to understand the nitty-gritty of the challenges and the process that will may likely come out of this particular challenges if he is to propose solutions.
This approach may not work for everyone. A spokesman for Mr. Buhari said on Wednesday that no cabinet announcements are likely before September. That sent stocks in Africa's largest economy tumbling. Chris Stein for VOA News, Dakar.
Minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The UN mission in the DRC, MONUSCO, has called on the government to deploy its police force more widely. Currently, only a small number of police officers patrol many of the areas with high crime rates, and a five-year program to reform the police is lagging. Nick Long has more from Goma in eastern Congo.
During a recent conversation with reporters in Goma, MONUSCO chief Martin Kobler touted the successes in joint army and UN operations against rebels, but he stressed the importance of following up those successes with a permanent police presence. We can fight against the armed groups, Kobler says, but if the state's authority and the civil administration are not restored and the PNC, or Congo's National Police, are not deployed, the end result will not be a success. As an example, Kobler mentioned Bukaringi territory, which he visited recently. He says in that territory there are 64,000 inhabitants in 400 square kilometres and only four police officers, so about one officer for 16,000 people. The normal ratio, he adds, is about one for every 500 people. The latest official figures suggest there are about 100,000 police in the DRC, or approximately one for every 700 people nationwide. But Gento Maundu, a former president of civil society groups in North Kivu province, told VOA that figure needs updating. Perhaps only 60% of the names on the police list are of real police, says Maundu, and the rest are out of date or fictitious, although somebody is still drawing their salaries. There are many territories like Bukaringi where police presence is minimal, says Swedish academic Maria Eriksson Bars, an expert on Congo's security services.
Well, I would say that in many areas in the east, that they're simply not present. But you will also see, I mean, in general in the Congo, that there is a strong concentration of the PNC in urban areas. So you see that also in the western parts, but it's more here in the east. And it's, of course, partly due to the security situation. But we have had many instances over the years with the PNC officers being killed in secure areas in the east.
There is clearly a limit to how far police can protect the population against armed groups. A government spokesman in South Kivu province, Minister Jean-Julien Miruho, told a public meeting in Bukavu recently that police had not intervened to prevent a nighttime massacre at the village of Mutarule last year because they lacked training. The police, Miruho says, are not trained for warfare, and when there is a lot of shooting, as there was that night, it is too much to expect people who are not trained to wage war to intervene at that time. In more peaceful areas, however, civilians also comment that the PNC are not widely deployed. This man in the village of Kibumba near Goma tells VOA that police are mainly to be found at public buildings, such as the offices of local chiefs and administrators, and elsewhere, if you explore the neighbourhood, you will not find them. The governor of South Kivu, Marcelin Chishambo, told the public meeting in Bukavu last month that the PNC is in training, and as it has had to incorporate many former rebels, this training cannot be completed in just 2 years. The governor was referring to a five-year reform and training program launched in 2012. One of the main donors, the British development agency DFID, has suspended its funding to the program. Nick Long for VOA News, Goma.
A South African nonprofit is sending seven lions to the Akagera National Park in Rwanda to reestablish the species that was wiped out following the 1994 genocide. The Associated Press reports officials from African Parks drove five female lions from Pinda Private Game Reserve in KwaZulu-Natal province and two males from a nearby reserve to the airport in Johannesburg for a flight to Rwanda this week. Cattle herders had poisoned Rwanda's last lions during a period when the country was trying to recover from the genocide. The lion transfer is part of a strategy to secure lions and boost the wildlife tourism industry industry in the country. The International Union for Conservation of Nature says lions in West Africa are critically endangered and that rapid population declines have also been recorded in East Africa. Well, in the U.S. is increasing its efforts to decriminalize laws and end discrimination against LGBTI people around the world. A senior U.S. official says addressing core issues of human rights will be at the heart of this global campaign. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
LGBTI issues increasingly are being discussed in a more transparent manner, with notable progress being made in some countries. Last year, a Ugandan court struck down a punitive anti-gay law, and earlier this year, Mozambique repealed its anti-gay legislation. Just last week, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that gay marriages in the United States are constitutional. LGBTI people, however, continue to face discrimination and danger to their safety throughout the world. Homosexuality remains illegal in 79 countries. It carries the death penalty in 8 of these nations. Ambassador Randy Berry is the U.S. State Department's first ever special envoy for the human rights of LGBTI persons. He was appointed to the post this year to advocate for their human rights with governments worldwide. He says the Obama administration wants to convey the message that this is a core human rights issue.
I think it is a reflection, really, of the administration's belief that elevating the conversation will help us alter the global balance, where I think we've seen some tremendous advancements in progress, but also where there are some very, very deep concerns and some deterioration of the human rights situation in a number of countries.
Berry tells VOA his job is to get countries to understand that harassing, torturing, jailing, and in some cases executing people because of their sexual orientation or gender identity is neither right nor acceptable. He says all people should be able to live free of persecution.
We certainly would like to see progress in terms of decriminalization of homosexuality in as many places as we can encourage that, where we can encourage greater space for civil society structures through our engagements with governments, our own direct engagement with civil society, our engagements with community of faith or the media. My hope is that we can open up some of that space, but at its heart, we are planting trees.
Berry says LGBTI issues involve long-term appreciation for human rights and long-term social change. He says that will take many, many years in some instances. Berry says he believes he can be particularly effective in his current position because of the understanding he brings. He says as one of the most senior openly gay officials within the U.S. State Department, he has an understanding of the dynamics both in the United States and in the global sense. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
This is Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and it's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joburg.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Gunmen shot and killed a security guard at a Cairo bank this morning. The streets of Burundi's capital appear calm today as the nation waits for results of last Monday's vote for members of parliament. And Reuters news agency reports the Liberian Ministry of Health today confirms a third case of the Ebola virus disease in Liberia. Coming up, we'll have music from Nigeria. And in our feature segment and our feature reports, I'm Kim Lewis and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Thursday, Sunny.
Happy Thursday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are kicking off today with Women's World Cup.
Kim, Sunday's Women's World Cup football final will be a rematch of the 2011 title game, Japan against the United States. The reigning world champion Japanese women advanced to the final again with a 2-1 semifinal victory over England in Edmonton, Canada. Japan's winning margin came off an own goal from England defender Laura Bassett, who accidentally sent the ball into her team's net in the 92nd minute while trying to clear the ball. Bassett was in tears after the match, and she was helped off the field by her teammates and England's head coach, Mark Sampson. Now, the Japanese were outplayed for much of the second half. Japan's head coach, Norio Sasaki, acknowledged there were several tense moments when England could have scored. But that's the game of soccer, Coach Sasaki said through a translator. And in the end, we were able to obtain a dramatic goal. The game's two earlier goals both came off penalty kicks in the first half. Aya Miyama put the Japanese in front 1-0 in the 33rd minute before England equalized 7 minutes later when Farrah Williams converted a penalty kick. The Japanese now travel southwest to Vancouver for Sunday's final against the USA, while England stays in Edmonton for Saturday's third-place match against Germany. The USA beat Germany 2-0 in the first semifinal Tuesday night. Abby Wambach, the most prolific scorer in international football history with 184 goals, came off the bench in the 80th minute for the United States. The USA's head coach, Jill Ellis, may very well use her in that same super sub role on Sunday against the Japanese. For now, though, Wambach says preparations are crucial ahead of the big title game.
I think the next couple of days are going to be huge because we haven't done anything yet. I know that beating a German team is something that you want to celebrate, but we still haven't won a World Cup. A lot of us were there in 2011, felt what it felt like to almost feel like it's meant to be, this meant to be feeling. But you got to go through those 90 or 120 minutes in that final, and you got to play well, and you got to finish your chances to call yourself a world champion. Japan did it 4 years ago. We want to do it this time around. So we can't take anything for granted. We can't take one moment off. We can't take 1 minute off. We have to make the perfect subs. We have to have those subs come in and make a difference like Kelly O'Hara did during the semifinal game. It's all those little intangibles. All those little things will add up, hopefully, to a World Cup. And, of course, you just can't stop believing and never doubt that it's going to happen. I'm really excited about the next couple days to get our team mentally, physically prepared. We've been prepping for this for years, and I feel like it's been a lifetime for me to play in my last World Cup game, it being the final. It's set up fairy tale-like, but we got to do the work. We got to put the work in order to win it.
That's Abby Wambach of the United States, who is hoping to win her first Women's World Cup trophy on Sunday in Vancouver, Canada. The 35-year-old Wambach was named the 2012 FIFA Women's World Player of the Year.
Hi, I'm Segun Adeyemi, coming to you all the way from Lagos, Nigeria. Weekends are for sports. Nightline Africa Sports, that is. And every Sunday, I'll give you highlights of the top sports stories of the past week and the weekend. Nightline Africa Sports from the Voice of America. Let the games begin.
We got the game on.
Game on, VOA sports fans. VOA's Jonah Haskell joins us now with a Thursday Wimbledon tennis update. Sporty greetings, Jonah.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Here's your Thursday Wimbledon update. Several of the world's top-ranked players took the court. Seven-time Wimbledon champ Roger Federer's mastery of grass courts was on display as he made American Sam Querrey look overmatched in a straight sets victory, 6-4, 6-2, 6-2. Andy Murray, the hometown favorite, defeated Robin Haas of the Netherlands with an impressive performance that saw Haas win only six games in a three-set rout. In 2013, Murray became the first British player to win Wimbledon in over 70 years when he beat Novak Djokovic in a hotly contested final. Djokovic, who won his second Wimbledon last year, has begun his title defense well, winning yesterday to advance to the third round. Next up for Novak will be Bernard Tomic, who Djokovic says he isn't going to underestimate.
This is the surface that he loves playing the most on, so it's going to be a difficult match. I remember back in, was it 2011, I think, quarterfinals, we played against each other, and four tough sets, so I'm not expecting anything easy there.
And you should never expect anything to be easy when you're playing in Wimbledon. In the women's bracket, former world number one Caroline Wozniacki beat the Czech Republic's Denisa Alertova to move closer to her first Wimbledon title, while another Czech player, Petra Kvitova, dispatched Karumi Nara of Japan in a 6-2, 6-0 shellacking. Kvitova, who has won Wimbledon twice before, including last year, was given the 2 seed for this year's tournament. The number 1 seed is American Serena Williams, who is looking to win her third major of the year. She'll face Heather Watson of the United Kingdom in the third round. Serena says Watson could be dangerous on Wimbledon's famous grass courts.
I don't know her at all. I just know I see her around the locker room a little bit, and she's always smiling, so she seems to be super sweet. I feel like she does really well in grass. Like, she played well in Eastbourne and for, you know, a couple times, and she's doing well in grass. Had a really good win today.
Williams will be hoping for a good win against Watson, who, at 23, will be looking to get past the third round at a major tournament for the first time. Back on the men's side, the only African at the tournament, Kevin Anderson, continued his success in London. The tall South African won again Wednesday, this time against Marcel İlhan of Turkey. If Anderson can win again in the third round, he'll likely face a fourth-round matchup with world number one Novak Djokovic. But before that can happen, Kevin is going to have to get through Leonardo Mayer, his third-round opponent, who should give Anderson a real challenge. With the Thursday Wimbledon update, I'm VOA's Jonah Haskell.
The National Basketball Association's annual free agency period is underway. Joining us now with an update is VOA's Toddy Abeje. Sporty greetings, Toddy.
Sporty greetings, Sonny. Paul Pierce has left the Washington Wizards and signed a 3-year, $10 million contract with the Los Angeles Clippers. Kawhi Leonard has re-signed with the San Antonio Spurs for 5 years and $90 million. Goran Dragic from Croatia re-signed with the Miami Heat for 5 years and $90 million. Kevin Love has re-signed with the Cleveland Cavaliers for 5 years and $110 million. Draymond Green has re-signed with the defending champions, the Golden State Warriors, for 5 years and $85 million. The big free agents left is LaMarcus Aldridge and LeBron James. In another note, Anthony Davis is one of the bright young superstars in the league, has signed a max contract of 5 years and $145 million to remain with the New Orleans Pelicans.
Toddy, you mentioned Paul Pierce to start off your report. I know my beloved Washington Wizards offered him more money than the Clippers. Why is he going to Los Angeles?
He's going to the Clippers because it's his hometown and he can be reunited with his coach, and the Clippers have a better chance of winning a championship than the Wizards do.
Do you think the Clippers will use him in the same role like the Wizards did?
Yes, they will, because the Clippers badly need a small forward, and they need someone that's clutch for them, and Paul Pierce is historically clutch.
Now, this LaMarcus Aldridge, you said he was the big name being bandied about. How many teams is he negotiating with?
He's negotiating with seven teams, but the number one team that most people expect him to go to is the San Antonio Spurs.
Why do you think that?
Because they are in better position to win right now than the other teams are. Like the Lakers and the Knicks have interest in him, but they're nowhere near winning.
I know you like to wave the banner of the Lakers, Toddy. And are they going to get Aldridge?
I hope so. I'm praying. Well, I hope so, but it doesn't seem likely.
Why is that?
Because there was a report says that LaMarcus Aldridge was not impressed by the presentation, which his camp said that he denied that. He was not impressed, but he was impressed.
How can you not be impressed by Kobe Bryant?
I don't know. He's getting a bad reputation of being a bad teammate. He's a great player. I don't know too many players that don't want to play with Kobe Bryant. He's a winner and he's a champion.
Now, one free agent I don't think you mentioned, Toddy, from Cameroon, Luc Richard Bamute. He played last year for the Philadelphia 76ers. Any chance the Wizards might get a player like that?
Hopefully, because he could be a good fit for them, and he could get away from the losing culture in Philadelphia.
I mean, that's a culture, though, that produced Dr. J.
That is true, but but they're in this culture of tanking to gain a high draft pick, and it's really sad. I feel bad for the fans of Philadelphia.
Now, in regards to this free agency period, Toddy, when can players, isn't there like a date when they can first sign with teams?
The date is actually July 9th where they can officially sign their contracts.
Okay, so then we'll know where these players are going.
Absolutely.
All right, Toddy Abeje with that NBA free agency update. I know there's going to be lots of money going around for these top basketball players. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Kim Lewis.
Okay. Thank you, Sonny. Thank you, Toddy. And thank you, Jonah. Yes. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC right here on the Voice of America. Well, coming up, the DRC holds its first specialty coffee tasting competition. And four U.S. lawmakers introduce a bill to promote affordable and reliable electricity in sub-Saharan Africa. First, here's Chin K. Pan of Nigeria with Sweet 16.
Move your body to this rhythm. Oh, oh, oh. Shake your body to this melody. Oh, oh, oh. Everybody, you are welcome to this party. Oh, oh, oh. Move your body to this rhythm. Oh, oh, oh. Oh yeah, shake your body to this melody. Oh, oh. Everybody, you are oh, welcome oh, to this party. We the key, I got a problem. We the
go. Why yo, why yo?
If you are really ready for this Takuruku gyration from Zule Zoo, let me see you stand up and bend your waist again like an African man will do. Come on, stop.
Chin Kai Pan of Nigeria with Sweet 16. Well, there's a revival in specialty coffee exports from the DRC. International experts recently held a specialty tasting competition in Bukavu for 30 entrants. This was the first specialty coffee competition ever held in the DRC. Nick Long files.
In the mid-1980s, the Democratic Republic of Congo was officially exporting up to 130,000 tons of coffee per year, but by 2012 that figure had shriveled to 8,000 tons owing to war, coffee disease, low prices and smuggling. However, international buyers of specialty high-quality coffee have started to realise they have been missing out. In 2012, the World Coffee Research Institute, after doing a survey of the two Kivu provinces in eastern Congo, described the area as a paradise for coffee. That same year saw a Congolese coffee cooperative break through into the world's specialty market, helped by the UK-based fair trade organisation Twin. Richard Hyde, one of Twin's coffee experts, suggests that many other cooperatives in the Kivu provinces could do the same.
We know that potentially all the coffee from South Kivu to North Kivu is great coffee. It's just a question of knowledge, of equipment, of follow-through.
The coffee tasting competition held on Wednesday was the real test of that proposition for the more than 30 cooperatives that took part. Another of the organisers, Chris Traitor of the US coffee buyer Higher Grounds Trading, explained the importance of the event.
This is a very historic day to have people from all across the value chain of specialty coffee in one place and trained judges testing and sampling the different coffees in the region that are traceable in order to evaluate them all on one table for the first time.
The competition used global standards drawn up by the Specialty Coffee Association of America. It was a blind tasting, meaning judges had no idea whose coffee they were sampling. It was a fairly silent process too, except when the judges noisily spat out each sample.
And keep the noise down, please.
The judges waxed lyrical about the entries to this competition. Here is Stephen E. Vick, a buyer and taster for Blue Bottle Coffee, talking about a sample that he graded 91 out of 100, an exceptionally high score.
I loved it from the beginning. The fragrance was, I think, the best of any of them we've had. It's super complex, lot of cherry, super silky body. I just wanted to drink the cups. They were just gorgeous.
Number one goes to CPCKS. Wow.
The winning cooperative, like several other entrants, had been helped by consultants working for Eastern Congo Initiative. The reason non-profits get involved in the sector is because much of Eastern DRC's coffee is produced by smallholder farmers working in very difficult conditions. One of the ways Eastern Congo Initiative tries to help those farmers is to lobby the DRC government on their behalf. The competition was an opportunity to do just that, as the Provincial Minister of Agriculture was attending. ECI's Baraka Kasali pointed out one way the DRC government could have helped producers of a coffee consignment recently sold to a new international buyer.
The biggest hurdle that I see is in the tax. Mm-hmm. We saw that during that first lot, 70% of the cost of that coffee went to taxes.
Congo's export tax on coffee is 12% compared with 1% in neighbouring countries. In reply to Kasali, the provincial agriculture minister, Adolphine Moulay, said perhaps the taxes are exorbitant. Nick Long for VOA News, Bukavu.
Well, four U.S. lawmakers have introduced into Congress a bill promoting affordable and reliable electricity in sub-Saharan Africa. They say electrical power is a must in order to improve economic growth, health, and education in Africa. VOA's Mariama Diallo talked with Tom Hart of the Anti-Poverty One organization about it.
U.S. Representatives Ed Royce, Elliot Engel, Chris Smith, and Karen Bass introduced the legislation Tuesday to help modernize sub-Saharan Africa's power structure and increase access to electricity. Tom Hart, the One Campaign's executive director in the U.S., applauds the legislation and says getting energy in Africa is essential.
7 out of 10 people in Africa have no access to electricity. And in rural areas, it's 9 out of 10. I mean, just imagine, you know, you can't refrigerate a vaccine. You can't study for an exam after dark. So many people have to cook and heat their homes by burning wood and other things inside their homes, releasing toxic fumes, let alone running a business.
Representative Chris Smith, the chairman of the House Africa Subcommittee and one of the sponsors of the bill, says these activities are usually taken for granted by many people, including him. He says this bill makes it more likely that millions of Africans can achieve the modern health and economic benefits of the 21st century. Hart explains what the legislation aims to achieve.
Access to electricity for the first time, 50 million. We're also trying to get at least 20,000 megawatts of new power on the continent, and that's distributed both in urban and rural areas. Very important to help get people who have no access at all in remote places where most people live.
Last summer, President Barack Obama announced Power Africa, an initiative with similar goals. Hart says this bill and the president's initiative will complement each other.
The bill would make permanent the president's initiative. We don't want to see this very, very good initiative from the president go away when he leaves office. Presidential initiatives and presidential leadership are critical, but equally important to making sure this lasts a long time and is successful is having both Republicans and Democrats on board. And that's what has been achieved through the introduction of this legislation.
He says the electricity bill is also a complement to AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act. You can't do trade unless products are made, and the lack of electricity is a major impediment to Africa trading with the world, he expressed. In Washington, Mariama Diallo, VOA News.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to African News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. Up next is our VOA editorial. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
While there's been much encouraging news about the Ebola epidemic in West Africa in recent months, new infections of the virus continue, and the United States remains committed to doing what it takes to stop them. U.S. Ebola treatment units and basic response infrastructure are in place, and thousands of U.S.-supported civilian responders are at work to fight the disease. It's killed more than 11,000 people in Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone, and a handful of other countries, including our own. Liberia has been declared Ebola-free, but is still within a 90-day period on heightened security for recurrence of the disease. New cases continue to emerge elsewhere, with 8 recently identified in Sierra Leone and 12 in Guinea. Cases continue in areas bordering Guinea-Bissau, and efforts to ensure that country is better prepared for Ebola cases are underway. The U.S. National Institutes of Health is conducting trials on various candidate Ebola vaccines, including a controlled trial on the effectiveness of one vaccine in particular. NIH is also testing therapeutic drug candidates to treat those who have been infected, working to improve diagnosis of the disease, which has so far required sophisticated, labor-intensive DNA analysis, and trying to better understand how it causes the disease. In other words, the United States is supporting a wide range of research on prevention and treatment of Ebola. Meanwhile, a partnership between U.S. and Liberian researchers is studying approximately 7,500 people in that country, including 1,500 who survived Ebola within the last 2 years. Health investigators want to better understand Ebola's long-term health consequences and determine if survivors develop long-term immunity that will protect them from future infection. They also would like to better understand how the Ebola virus can persist in some organs of survivors long after they appear to have recovered, and the degree of risk that they can transmit the virus to others. While we have succeeded in controlling the exponential growth of the disease, getting to zero cases will require a sustained international response. The fight is far from over, and we remain committed to achieving an Ebola-free West Africa. The research U.S. and other scientists are carrying out now will improve the odds of preventing any future outbreak of Ebola from spreading, as the 2014 epidemic did.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
If you come into contact with the bodily fluids of a person infected with Ebola, you must wash with soap and water immediately. I'm Dr. Conde Greaves. The Ebola virus is only present in the blood, feces, vomit, breast milk, sweat, and semen of people who are seriously ill. The virus must get into your body to infect you. Do not touch your eyes, nose, or mouth, and cover any cuts on the skin. If you are caring for someone who has Ebola, do not handle bedding, towels, or clothes that may be soiled with bodily fluids without gloves. Avoid sexual activity with male survivors of Ebola. Men carry the virus in semen for up to 90 days. Ebola cannot survive for long outside the body. Sunlight, heat, Clorox, and alcohol will kill the virus. Know the facts about Ebola. Knowledge is life.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.